Well, Sonia, first of all, it is great to speak to you and it is great to meet you, and you're very welcome to Kerry. And of course, when I talk about Sonia Sullivan and talk about Kerry, the only real connection I could bring up would be Maureen Harrington.
Yeah, well, Maureen was, we were part of the cross country team on a number of occasions, but I suppose the ones that I would remember the most would be 1997. I think it was in Turin in Italy, and it was one of the two times the Irish team, we won a bronze medal at the World Cross Country, and Maureen was on the team with me. And, you know, it was one of those great occasions, you know, to have a great group of Irish girls. You know, I suppose it was myself and Katrina at the front, but we were backed up strongly by people like Maureen Harrington and Valerie Vaughan. And I remember, you know, for me, it would have been, you know, being up there trying to get a medal or win the race. And, you know, I kind of started to slip back a bit in the field, and a couple of the Irish girls went past me. And then there was people on the side, and they, come on, Sonia, come on, do it for the team, you know. And that was one of the few occasions, I suppose, when athletics, you know, had that team feel for me, which you would rarely get in athletics. And, you know, people like Maureen Harrington, you know, great character, great, you know, always up for a laugh, part of the team. And, you know, it was just one of those things that you remember as, you know, having a good time. And, and again, I think in 1998, the same. At the World Cross Country, Maureen was on the team, and we remember running around. I actually won both races, and it was, you know, it was just so much going on and the excitement of it all. And all I wanted to do, I suppose, after was to just go for a jog, and Maureen ran around the course with me, and we just jogged around, and everybody else had disappeared off from their buses back to the hotels, and we were just jogging around the course. And, you know, it was one of those things that you just wanted to talk to somebody, and, you know, no better person than Maureen.
I suppose, Sonia, one of the big things of your life in athletics and on a broad basis was meeting people, and those people that you met, the people you ran with and against and befriended, would that be a big part of your life?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, from the very beginning, I think, you know, I suppose that what made me enjoy the being part of the teams and travelling, because you do travel so much, you're away from home a lot, was the friends that you meet, and then looking forward to going away again and spending time with the same people. I mean, originally people like Marcus O'Sullivan and Frank O'Mara, you know, they would have made me feel very welcome on the Irish team. And, you know, they were the ones who inspired me. And then, I mean, Marcus, he used to say that I inspired him, you know, because I was so committed and dedicated and doing all the extra little bits and pieces that he thinks that, you know, watching me gave him a little bit of longevity to his career towards the end.
Yeah. You were born in Cove. Were you born to run, Sonia?
I don't know if I was born to run now, but I think in Cove is one of those places where, I suppose when I was growing up, not many mothers drove, you know, and my mother never drove. She still hasn't driven. So, you know, my dad would go to work in the morning and he'd take the car and you'd never see it again till the evening. So, you know, we definitely were not shuttled around the place. And if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to walk. And Cove is a very hilly place. So, you know, wherever you go, you've got to come back up a hill at some stage. My grandmother used to live at the far side of town. You know, we were out one end. And then there was top of the hill in the middle, right down, looking down at the cathedral in Cove and out to the sea. And then up the hill to the other side was my grandmother. So, you know, we would spend days and you'd be walking from one end of the town to the other. And I used to run to school, walk to school in the morning with the bag, and then at lunchtime run home, have lunch and back again. And, you know, within an hour you had to run home, have your lunch, watch a bit of telly and run back again. So, you know, you always kind of felt, well, the quicker you get home, the more you can do when you're at home. I don't know what it was we were doing, but you just wanted to have a break from school. And
what was it like growing up in Cove? It's a beautiful place, a beautiful seaside town, beautiful cathedral, and it's a very historic place. Jack Doyle, the great boxer, is buried there. I visited his grave one time down there. What was Cove like as a young girl growing up? Were you happy there?
I was very happy in Cove, yeah. I mean, it was a place where, I suppose, it was very a safe place, you know. You could walk everywhere. You never thought twice about walking anywhere. And, you know, my schools, they were so close. And, yeah, I mean, it was one of those places I just enjoyed it, you know. And running, I suppose, once running became part of my life, I used to run everywhere. I can remember, you know, even simple things like my mother would tell me to go to the shop and buy something. And I can remember running out the door, around the corner and up to the shop. And years later, I would come back and you'd ask you to go to the shop. And at this stage, you know, I'd be about twice the height, and and you would still run out the back door, and like you were when you were 10 years old, you know, and leg it round the corner, and then you'd kind of think, what am I doing?
Can you see that in your two little daughters now? Are they running like when you run when you were their age? Can you see anything like that in them?
In my youngest daughter, definitely, yeah. She's very enthusiastic, and she runs everywhere. Like, if I ask her to do anything, she's always running, and...
Does she remind you of yourself?
Oh, she does, yeah, in lots of ways, yeah. Yeah, she's very... she's non-stop, doesn't sit still. My older daughter, Kira, she's very interested in sports, and she'd have all the stats and numbers and everything for you, but she doesn't like the running too much. She doesn't like it when it gets hard, you know? So I think that's the difference, you know, if you're going to be a runner. I think, you know, she grew up with running when she was young. She came to the track with us quite a lot, and I don't know, maybe she just had enough of it and made up her mind that she wasn't going to run, but she's a lovely runner, Kira. She's, you know, if you see her in the distance, you can see she runs lovely, but...
She has the style, like they say here in Kerry, about footballers.
Yeah, so when she's older, she might like to do it, you know, but, you know, I mean, my belief is you don't push them into anything and you allow them to do what they want. Kira, she's into her music and studying and everything like that. She's
lovely. Yeah. Lovely. It was very obvious following your career and watching you that your mother and father were always very close to you after the big races, when you were up and when you were down. The first people you'd go to would be your mother and father, and they played a huge part and still do in your life.
Oh, they do. I mean, you know, I had great support from my parents, you know. I mean, I never have expected them to travel around the world, you know, to watch me run races. And, you know, they used to go along and just... You know, I would be so focused on, you know, the race, you know, at the World Championships, the Europeans and the Olympics. They would just organise it all themselves, you know, and they would just turn up. I wouldn't know where they were staying or how they were getting, nothing about it. But they would, that would be kind of their, I suppose, holiday in a way for the summer, you know, to go off to all these different countries and go and watch me running the races. And I think my father, he used to love it, you know. My mother was very nervous and she'd hate to watch sometimes. She'd go out the back and she'd be hiding from it, and I think, you know, she was just always afraid that something was going to happen to me, you know, that you know, so I don't know what, but you know, that I suppose it's just a nervous thing when you're watching people compete and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you do get that little bit more nervous, I think. Whereas my dad, he always wanted to be kind of the centre of attention and right involved. He wanted to be right down there, you know. When I crossed the line, he'd always turn up with a flag or something on the side of the stadium. And, you know, you would think, well, how did he get down there? You know, he was sitting way up the top there during the race.
Yeah. Before we delve into the highlights of your career, Sana, and your career is so vast and just so brilliant and just so amazing that it's impossible, of course, even though in your book you describe it very vividly with Tom Humphreys, a beautiful book and very well written, let me add. And looking back at your whole career now, are you astounded at what you achieved? Did you ever think when you set out as a young girl in Cove that you would dominate the world in athletics for a long number of years?
Oh, not in the slightest, no. I mean, it would have been probably the furthest thing from my mind, really. You know, I mean, to me, it was always one thing at a time. And, you know, going from Cove to Villanova, you know, was a big step in itself, you know, to go to America and be a part of the team at Villanova. I suppose that was, for me, it was a way out, because in Cove, you know, I was running by myself a lot of the time, running laps of the field. And I just wanted to go and be a part of a team and be somewhere where there was a environment, I suppose, that people were doing the same thing I was doing. And you just kind of had the support network that you would need, you know, which, you know, a lot of athletes would struggle with that. It's a very kind of lonely sport at times. And, you know, to meet up with, to have groups of people to train with is, you know, the greatest thing that any athlete can have. And, you know, to just kind of be brave enough to, I suppose, go away from the comfort zone of being at home and to do something different, just to join a training group. It's amazing the difference it makes to, you know, the ability to train harder but not realise that you're doing it.
Did you find it difficult to be so disciplined? I mean, you must have been one of the most disciplined Irish women of all time in relation to sport, and to get yourself disciplined and to train on your own. And then, as you said yourself there, you train with groups. Did you develop the discipline?
I think it kind of grew on me, you know. I think what happens is you get a taste of success and you like it, and then I think you want a bit more, so you go out there and you try harder, and you look, you kind of, I suppose, you investigate a lot, you study, read books, and you just try and work out how you can be better. And so you're always out there trying to change things, little one percenters, and just get something extra to make yourself that little bit better. So I think I was always, I suppose, always reading. I'm a very avid reader, you know, and I would always be looking at, you know, what's good things to eat and, you know, different training methods and reading about other athletes and even just looking up results and how people were doing. And so you'd pick out times that you'd be trying to chase yourself, like things like Irish records and, you know, eventually world records and European records, and look at things that you believed were achievable and then go out there and try and do it.
Who would you have admired when you were coming, when you were breaking into athletics, when you were a young girl? What athletes would you have admired, Sonia, and who influenced you?
I suppose the very beginning, the biggest influence in my career would have been Sean Kennedy, my coach in Cove, and also Pat O'Halloran, who was the main coach at the Ballymore Cove Athletic Club. And what Pat did really was he made it fun. You know, we as a big group of us used to go up there and, you know, you do the warm-up and there'd be a lot of chat and laughing. And, I mean, that's what you need. You need to make it enjoyable and somewhere that you like to go to. It was like, I suppose it was a club, but it was like our own little club. You know, you went there and you had fun and you laughed. And, you know, it wasn't hard work at all. It was great. And, I mean, the thing there was gradually, I suppose, as you get older, a lot of the girls kind of tend to fall away and you can be left by yourself running around. And I was lucky enough that there was a few boys up the track and I would jump in with them sometimes and run with them, especially in the evenings after school now when it would be dark. But I suppose, you know, that's when I discovered Sean Kennedy as well. You know, I was looking for a coach and it was one of those things. I just kind of, over the years, had heard stories of this coach, you know, who used to have people run up the hills out the back. And, you know, he was a renowned coach, but I think he must have not coached for a while. And so I just called him up on the phone and asked him if he could give me a training program, just like that, you know, out of the blue. And I think he was shocked, you know. Yeah. He was like, you know, who's this girl and what she, why does she want to get a training program from me? And, you know, he was kind of thinking, well, where do I begin? You know, so he just got me to, I suppose, write down what I had been doing and what I wanted to do. And then he used to write me some training programs.
Before I forget it, I must mention one man. You'd know him, and I was lucky enough to come across him and know him, Father Liam Kelleher. Oh, and he ran the Ballycotton 10. I jogged it a few years myself. But I'd just like to talk about Father Liam Kelleher, because I know that he had been ill lately, but he's coming around again. And a remarkable man.
Unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. Father Liam, he just turned up everywhere, you know. I mean, there was a number of times he would have been the team manager, I think, when we were on the European junior teams. He had a great club down in North Cork. He had Anita Philpott, was one of the athletes there who I used to compete against a lot. And, you know, he had the ideal setup, really, where you had a big group of kids all running and training together. And I remember, you know, he had the Marathon magazine and you'd read That's about right, them all yeah. going off to training camps down in, yeah. probably down here in Kerry, you know, or West Cork or somewhere. You know, I remember him talking about sand dune training and they'd go off for weekends. And of course, I would be envious of this, thinking, gee, that'd be great to do that. And, you know, we had a small club and we had, I suppose, you didn't have the same kind of organisation or motivation as a big club, you know, with someone behind it, like Father Kelleher, who was very enthusiastic and very interested, I suppose, in the development of young athletes. And sure, the teams used to win everything at the All-Irelands and the Munsters.
You loved running in the Ballycotton 10. Tell me about your record in it.
I did. Well, I only ran there once. Yeah. And it was amazing, really. It was just by chance I got to run there. It was the year 2001 when they had the foot and mouth disease. And so it was postponed to June. And I just happened to be around the place and I ran there. I was actually pregnant at the time with my, which daughter? I think with Sophie, yeah. And so I just went down for the run and won the race. And, you know, it was one of those things. It was a race I always wanted to run in, always wanted to win it. And to be able to do it, you know, once in my life, it was kind of like, well, I've done that now.
Our lady listeners will be interested in what you just mentioned, running when you were pregnant. And how long did you run until, and after you the birth of your daughters then, Sonia, when did you come back? Give our listeners an idea about how you handled the pregnancy and the birth of your two daughters.
Well, I'll tell you now, if I took out my training diary and looked back at the training I did, you know, before they were born, I would be amazed. I couldn't do that training now, you know. It's like amazing. I just can't. What I think in my mind was that, well, if you just continue doing what you're doing, then if you continue every day, then you don't notice that you're gaining weight or that things are changing. But a couple, you know, the first time with Kira, I ended up having a little bit of a foot injury, so I had to stop training, running, I think, at about 30 weeks. And so I had a few weeks off. And then, of course, when I started back, it was a hard work then, you know, because I was a bit bigger and it was a bit awkward and everything else. And I didn't really enjoy running then, so I stopped altogether. But I went into the gym and went on the exercise bike and continued on with my training for weight training and everything like that. And the same again with Sophie. I ran for about 20 weeks and again had little bits of niggly injuries. And so I decided it was a good opportunity to stop running and to sort out the injuries so that when the girls were born, then I would be able to, I wouldn't have any injury problems and I'd be able to get back into training again. So with Sophie, I did a lot of spinning classes right up until the day she was born. I remember being in a spinning class and I came out of the spinning class and it was the 23rd of December and 2 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
I came out of the spinning class and I went to do a few weights and I thought, gee, there's something not right here. But I was determined to get through the session, you know, because I always had this thing.
Your discipline again?
It was discipline, but I also always had this thing in my mind, and I think this was even more so before Kira was born, that, you know, once, because I didn't know, you know, the first child, what life was going to be like afterwards. So I kind of thought, well, I have all this time to myself right now. All of a sudden, this time's going to be taken away as soon as I have to look after a baby. So I just wanted to use as much time as I could to maintain fitness and to do exercise. Like, I used to walk everywhere, you know, just walk and walk and walk. And then I suppose after the girls were born, I continued walking and I used to walk straight away. You know, I think, you know, that was my way of getting back to fitness. And then when I started to feel stronger, I'd be out with the pram and I'd do a bit of a walk jog type of thing. And there was a couple of occasions where it would start raining and I'd just start running with the pram and think, you know, then you'd be running out of the rain. But it was a, you know, you were actually testing yourself as well, yeah, to see lovely, if you could actually run.
Lovely story. Come here. We'll move on. Your first major win, and you brought the medal with you to Kerry this weekend, and we'll talk about your heart, man. Talk about your first major win, Sonia. It was Gothenburg, wasn't it?
It was.
How did that come about?
It was, well, Helsinki was the European Championships in 1994, and in 1993 I had finished fourth in the Olympics in 1992, so that was when I first kind of, you know, had a belief that I belonged, you know, up there with the world-class runners. And, you know, up to that point, my name would stand out in a start list like it didn't belong there. And then I think after I finished fourth at the Olympics in 92, I started to kind of read start lists and I'd look at the people that I could beat. You know, you'd start crossing names off and then you might reduce the race down to about five people. Mm-hmm. And so it would be a much smaller race. You just kind of discount some people. A bit like now when I read a menu and trying to decide what to eat. I'd say, no. Cross off all the things that, you know, don't belong there. And you have the ones left that belong.
Yeah.
So when I was in the few that belong, then you gain a lot of confidence and belief in yourself. And in 1993, after the Olympics, I went out and, you know, won a number of races, broke so many Irish records. But then when we came to the World Championships, the Chinese athletes turned up. So when I would have been, you know, I suppose, favourite for the 3,000 metres and 1,500 metres, in 1993, I ended up second in the World Championships, 1,500 metres. But that gave me, I suppose, determination to go out there and to train harder and to really try and, you know, push the boundaries and see how far I could go. And, you know, I think, I mean, a lot of time I was making decisions myself. You know, my coach would tell me, you know, he'd give me the sessions to do. And then you'd kind of fill in the other days by yourself and you'd run as hard as, you know, as I suppose as hard as it, as good you felt. You know, if you felt good, then you'd run hard. And if you felt a bit tired, then you might run a little bit slower. But, you know, it was one of those things where I really tried hard. And so when it came back around to 1994 for the European Championships, then I was kind of racing all over Europe, breaking records, winning races. And I think the week before the European Championships, I was beaten in a race and finished about fifth, and all of a sudden everybody was having question marks over me, you know, is she going to do this now, or is she going to have thrown it all away by racing around Europe? And I remember going in a hotel room and having a number of Irish journalists come in, and we had a little mini press conference, and, you know, they wanted to know how I was going to go. And I mean, it was very negative kind of questions, you know, thinking, you know, had I overdone it, you know, did I peak too early? And I managed to kind of, you know, turn all the questions around and say, no, I was really happy to, you know, delighted to be here. And I believe that I was the person in the race who most wanted to win the race, because I felt like, you know, I was owed it from the year before at the World Championships, when it was taken away at the last minute by the, you know, appearance of these unknown Chinese. And then, you know, to go out and win the European Championships, it was such a relief, you know, to finally win a gold medal at a major championship.
It was, yeah. It was brilliant. And I'm bringing you back to the year before now, to the Chinese. That was on in Stuttgart. I can still visualise looking at the television and seeing this big long string of runners all around the track and these three Chinese leading out and everybody dumbfounded about what was happening, Sonia. And I know that you were dumbfounded and everyone was. Talk to us about those World Championships and the Chinese, how they came on the scene, how they disappeared, and the big thing was, what were they on? Was it legal or illegal? I suppose you're tired of answering it, are you?
Well, you know, it's a while ago now. It is nearly, 9 years ago, you know, yeah, since the 1993 World Championships. And, I mean, they just kind of took the world by storm, really. I mean, people refer to it as the Chinese takeaway, you know. They just came in and they took all the medals, and it was the first year ever they had Mercedes-Benz prizes, you know. And, you know, they went off with them all. But, you know, supposedly the coach was taking all these cars, and, you know, it was a very, you know, the state-run system and everything. So it really was a kind of it was nearly kind of like a, I don't know, it was very structured. And, you know, you didn't feel like the girls really knew what they were doing. You know, they were being kind of, they were, every time they would turn up to go to breakfast, they'd be marching down in their tracksuits. And it was very kind of military style and, yeah, very, you know, it wasn't natural, I suppose, the whole thing. And people used to go to the track and watch them training. You know, they would be running races and they'd be out in the track the next day doing these unbelievable training sessions. And as it turned out, the World Championships, where they were winning all the medals, that was only like a warm-up for the Chinese, for the Asian Games, where they went off and they broke world records and ran, you know, phenomenal times that nobody has come anywhere near. Things like 8:06 for 3,000 metres and 29:31, I think it was, for 10,000 metres. You know, it was out of this world, really, what they were doing, and a bit of a mystery. And everybody, I suppose, wanted to know what they were doing. There was all these stories about turtle blood and, you know, running a marathon a day and all sorts of things like that, that, you know, you were never really sure what was going on. And, I mean, there's never really been any answer to it, you know.
Did you ever meet them, Sonia? Did you chat with any of them, or did you ever come across any of them later in life?
I did. The one girl, Lu Dong was her name, she won the 1500 when I finished second.
You were second that year?
Yeah. So it was one of those things where, you know, I was favoured for the 3,000 metres and ended up fourth. And then in the 1500 metres, I was determined I was going to get a medal. So I kind of thought, no matter what, I'm going to, like, do everything I possibly can here now to get a medal. And, you know, managed to come away with the silver, which, you know, looking at the race, it was the best I could have done. You know, I couldn't do, Lou, who won, she just phenomenal storming last lap, you know, that, you know, was, you know, it was something I could never have done. You know, I was just unable to run that fast. And I met her a couple of times afterwards, but, you know, she spoke Chinese and, you know, we communicated a little bit. But I think she was the one who broke away first. She had long hair and that was kind of frowned upon by the coach. So she was the one to first leave the group, and she didn't run in the Olympics in 1996 when they did run there again. And then I met her only last year at the World Cross Country Championships in Spain. And she's living in Spain now and married to a Spanish man, and she was just jogging around, you know.
Did she discuss her running career with you? Or did you go into how they trained her?
No, we didn't even go anywhere near it, you know. It was nearly a kind of no-go area, you know.
Looking back in it now, Sonia, did they disappear from the scene then? I don't hear about them now or after that. What happened to all those Chinese runners?
Well, I mean, amazingly, they did disappear. And, you know, even when they had the Olympics in Beijing, you kind of thought, oh, they're going to come back here again now, but never did. And, you know, the amazing thing about when the Chinese runners kind of came and went was that it was all women runners. There was no men. And, you know, there was talk, you know, that they were maybe they had the bodies like young boys, you know, and that maybe they had some hormonal things that might have made them a bit more male than female, you know. You've had issues with that kind of recently as well. But, nobody ever got to the bottom of it, and somehow it was brushed under the table, you know. So I mean, we need like a bit of a Lance Armstrong type investigation,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, we might talk about him later on. You ran in 4 Olympics, Sonia. It was, even to be an Olympian once is a great thing. We have a good number of Olympians in Kerry, of course, and we have great oarsmen, and of course, Gillian O'Sullivan would be one of our great Olympic ladies. And you'd have met Gillian, of course, and you'd know her.
Of course, Gillian is fantastic, you know. I mean, to win the silver medal, was it in 2003, I think in Paris, yeah. I mean, absolutely fantastic, you know. I mean,
unfortunately, injury brought her career prematurely to halt.
It did, you know. Yeah. She never really got to back it up. I think, you know, she did struggle a lot with injuries after that. But I see Gillian every now and then. Now, she lives in Cork, so I see her there. I saw her recently. She actually was out for a run with she had a little boy, I think, in pushing him in the pram.
And you'd meet Tom O'Riordan and Jerry Kiernan and people like that, all great Kerry Olympians.
Oh yeah, well, Tom, of course, he followed me very closely there throughout my career. He was like, you know, one of the a few of them went around there together. Tom and Peter Byrne and Brendan Mooney, you know. There was there wasn't one without the other, you know. And we used to always have this laugh, you know, that you tell them all the story, and I said they must all get together, and one of them writes, and the other they all take it, you know.
By the way, how did you get on with the media generally throughout your career? How did you find them overall, and did you find problems with certain media people?
Not really, no. I mean, I'm sure I definitely went through periods where I would have been a little bit kind of, I wouldn't have been as close to the media. I would have kind of kept my distance, which I suppose a lot of people probably do in their careers, you know. And then as I got older, I suppose you learn that, well, you can actually use the media to help you as well, you know. And you talk to them when you need a bit of propping up and giving a bit of positive support, you know. And when you know that you're going to run well, then if you let them know that, then they'll write a nice story about you. And then before the Olympics in 2000, I had a terrible race in London. It was a couple of weeks before we headed off down to Australia. And I remember someone said to me, what you need to do now is you need to call up somebody in the media that you know, someone you trust, and you tell them that it was a debate whether I was going to run in this Grand Prix race in Zurich or not, because I had such a disastrous race. And they said, you call them up and you tell them you're fine, you're going to run this race and everything is positive. And then you start to believe it yourself and you've told them. So then there's a little bit of expectation. So there's a little bit of pressure on you, but you need that. And then you need to go out there and you deliver. And I did exactly that. I called up Peter Byrne and I told him I was going to run this race in Zurich. And, you know, the whole thing was that they were never to kind of question me or to... I was just telling the story tell him the story. And that was probably the first time ever that I was able to use the media to, you know, put a good picture in my corner, to all of a sudden change the kind of, people were getting a bit worried and doubting, you know, my ability to, you know, come back out and run well in the Olympics again. I was starting to maybe doubt myself a little bit, and I just needed to kind of regain the confidence in the supporters, regain the confidence in the media, you know, so that they would be back on my side again. And just had to get everybody back in my corner so that I felt strong and that I could actually go out there and perform again.
the one thing that's coming through to me, Sian, in the short time that we're speaking, is it's all about confidence. You're building up your confidence. It's all about positivity and no negativity. And you wouldn't surround yourself with negative people.
No. I mean, and that's the thing. Athletics is a very individual sport. But you need a team around you. And, you know, the team that I had around me, you know, throughout the 90s, people, I had Marcus O'Sullivan, Frank O'Mara, Gerard Hartman. You know, these were people, Kim MacDonald, who was my manager and became my coach. And, you know, these were people who, they believed in me. And they would see, I suppose, if I was having any, like, worries or doubts or fears or anything like that, and they would just make sure that you were thinking positive, and you just had this very, I suppose, you always had a positive energy about the place. And, you know, it just meant that you weren't bogged down in all the detail and the training and the specifics, that you actually could relax and have a bit of fun, but then when you needed to concentrate on the race, you did, you know. So I don't think that you can, I'm not the type of person who is very intense all the time. I need a bit of relaxation, I need a bit of fun, a bit of chat and distraction from what I'm actually trying to do.
Yeah.
But then once it comes to the real hard training or the race, then, you know, I can turn the switch on then and then just go for it. And I think I also need, I suppose, people in my corner to back me up and to support me. And when you have people who are kind of believing in you, then you believe more in yourself as well, and you have more confidence to go out there and to do what you're capable of doing.
Yeah, you're giving a great insight into what it takes to become a world international star. Your first Olympics, Sonia, we'll just go through them fairly quickly, was Barcelona, of course. Was it exciting to somebody telling you you're an Olympian, and they build up to it, and were you overawed going into the what?
Yeah, probably a bit of all that. You know, I suppose at the time you didn't think too much about it. You know, I remember I spent that summer in Cove before the Olympics, and people would be coming up to me all the time and they'd be saying, "When are you going?" You know, and I used to go on the train to Cork to go training, and you'd meet people every day and they'd be saying, "When are you going?" And I used to think, "Where am I?" I said to them, "Where? Going where?" And, you know, because it wasn't in my mind. People say, "Do you think about the Olympics every day?" You don't, you know, you can't, because then it just becomes too intense. And I suppose things like that, they can add a little bit to the pressure and, you know, the expectation when you have everybody watching you. And that's what happens, you know, in Olympic years, is the difference between an Olympics and a World Championships and an European Championships, is that because every sport is involved, and anybody who has any interest in any sport knows that the Olympics are on. So the focus, you know, for the whole year is on the Olympics, and, you know, everybody knows that if you have Irish athletes who are successful in the Olympics, then it just creates a whole kind of, just there's a great energy about the place, and people get behind us, you know, all the time. And so you just want to go out there and deliver it, and I suppose to be able to manage the expectation and the ability that you have is a very difficult thing to do. So, you know, in Barcelona I really didn't have that much expectation at all, you know. I didn't know what to expect. I remember when the gun went off, I couldn't believe how it felt easy, you know, and I won my heat and easily got into the final, and I just couldn't believe how they were just jogging around, you know. And then it came down to a big battle over the last lap, and, you know, to be, I suppose, nearly getting a bronze medal, you know, is one of those things that I always say, if I knew I was going to be that close, then, you know, you would have made sure you got the bronze medal, and you might have done things a little bit differently. But, you know, that's the way it was. And I think, you know, that's what allowed me to believe that I belonged and allowed me to go out there and to, you know, be more involved in the races after that.
You finished fourth in that race, Sonia, in the 3,000 metres. But the girl that won it was tested positive for drugs in the following year. And looking back now, I mean, you must question the way things were going, were you?
Oh, absolutely. At that time, you know, it was very questionable. A lot of the Soviet Union, I think it was Russia, had kind of broken up, and they had this team. It was the CIS or something. It was a unified team. And I think first and second were both, I think, tested positive for drugs. I think the girl who won, she's not alive anymore. She died at, like, age 43. Yeah. You know, when you see things like that, then you kind of think, you know, is it worth it, you know? I mean, why would you, you know, put things in your body that's going to, you know, cut your life short so early, you know? I mean, it can't be worth that.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever offered to take drugs? Have you ever tempted yourself?
No, I never. I mean, you know, people, they talk about drugs a lot and, you know, they say people are out there all cheating. But no, never came across it at all. You know, it was amazing. You know, you hear stories and rumours and whispers and everything else. But I was definitely someone, I didn't really get involved in any discussions. And you just kind of felt like, well, if you get yourself bogged down in talking about what other people are doing, then you're kind of taking the focus away from yourself. And I mean, my feeling was to get out there and to do the best that I could do. And, yeah, you know, if there was someone else beating me, then they were either better than me or, they were, as long as I ran my best, then you had to be happy with that and to accept it. And then you move on and you just go to the next race.
Atlanta, then 1996, Sonia. I suppose it's a different. Oh, she says, yeah. It's a
different. We'll try to
have one little peep in there anyway. I know that I'd be like millions of more people watching it. It was, it's even harder for me to talk about it to you. So what's it like for you, really? But, and you describe in your book about it, that you were really coming up to it. And is there such a thing as being overtrained? You knew going in. Mm-hmm. Really, correct me if I'm wrong, that you weren't right, Sonia, but you told nobody.
I did, yeah. I mean, I had a couple of weeks before where my training was not very good, you know, and I wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't feeling good when I went training, and I just couldn't really understand it. And I think I always describe it as where you're going up a big hill and, you know, the peak, people talk about peaking, you know, at the right time during the year. And we always say that, you know, you want to peak, you know, right probably just below the peak, because then you're nearly at the best that you can possibly be. If you go over the top, then it's very very hard to come back up again, you know, because if you're on the way up, then, you know, you're better off being on the way up than on the way down, because when you're on the way down, you come down very fast, you know, whereas if you're up very high, you've got there gradually. And the last little bit is very slowly, but if somehow you push it that little bit too hard, you just go over the edge. Yeah. And that's where you start to get sick and little illnesses and, you know, different things that they just don't allow you to perform at the best you can. And, you know, it's too late then. There's very little you can do to recover.
And why didn't you go and tell people? You had your doctors and you had physios and you had a big team around you, but you kept it all to yourself.
I suppose I didn't really have any personal doctor or physio. I mean, the only person with Gerard Hartman now would have been the only one. But I suppose at the time they were all just kind of, it was so close to the Olympic Games that they were just hoping for the best, you know, and there's not a lot you can do about it. Even if you did tell someone, I mean, I'm not sure what they can tell you to do that is going to help you at that point.
How distressing then was the actual race for you, Sonia?
Oh, yeah, no, it was terrible, you know. You just wanted to kind of a hole in the track, you know, and go in there and not, you know, you didn't want to have to walk off the track and to face the media. And, you know, I think when I did walk off the track, which, you know, was a rare thing for me to do, I would have known where the media were, because there's a mix zone you have to walk through. So of course I went off the track 100 metres before, so I could go out a different door. And you know, eventually you do have to face up to, you know, everybody, you know, is there expecting you to do well, and all of a sudden it's kind of gone from, you know, great hope to no hope. And, you know, how do you explain it? And, you know, the hardest thing is that you have to explain it to yourself and work it out yourself. Sometimes you don't get to do that before you're expected to explain it to the media and to everybody at home who wants to know what went wrong, you know. And
your father was there waiting for you, wasn't he?
He was. I think he took the brunt of it, didn't he? He had the answer that silenced them all.
Yeah, no one died.
Nobody died. We'll all get up tomorrow and, you know, we'll continue on what we were doing today. And you know, it's true. And I suppose it's true in all sports that, you know, you can't always, I suppose, do what you... There's always going to be some little things along the way that don't go according to plan.
But you still went out and ran in the 1500 metres a few days later.
I did.
And which was probably, in retrospect, a mistake, but...
Oh, I mean, of course it was. But, you know, it was one of those things that I had trained for, you know, 4 years since Barcelona to go out there and to do better than Barcelona. And you just kind of thought, well, I've got to wait another 4 years before I get a chance again. So maybe it was just today. Maybe tomorrow I'll be a little bit better. And maybe it's a 1500, it might be okay over the shorter distance. So you just go out there and, yeah, no, it was one of those things where I suppose your mind is trying to compensate for your body, and your mind wants to do it, but your body doesn't, and no cooperation there, so you have no chance, really. And
then in Sydney 2000, of course, there was a huge difference, there was a vast difference, because you achieved your ambition and you won your silver medal, Sonny. Everything that you... Had you learned a lot from Atlanta and the disappointment? And is there such a thing as being overtrained? Am I using the right word?
Overtrained is a kind of way of simplifying it, I think. You know, there's probably a lot of other things involved there, and that's just kind of a title that you put on it, you know, that it didn't work out, and... you know, push too hard, you know, for too long. And after 1996, it took me the following year in 97, I went to the World Championships, and it was actually the year, I mean, when we were finished third in that World Cross Country Championships. But, you know, as good as it was to get the bronze medal, I didn't 100% enjoy it, because I was out there trying to win the race myself. You know, I didn't get that. So, you know, I was trying too hard, really, to make up for 1996. And the same, I went to the World Championships in Athens, and I didn't even make the final in the 5,000 metres. You know, I was fit and I was training really well, but my head really wasn't in a good place. You know, it wasn't really where it should be. And so there was, you know, there was a lot of, I suppose I lost faith with, in, I lost faith, I suppose, in belief in myself, and other people lost the faith and the belief in me as well. And so all of that takes away, it drains you, really. So I remember after the 1997 World Championships, I called up my coach back in London, Alan Storey was his name, and, you know, I was kind of like devastated. I could hardly speak to him, you know, I was like in bits out the back of the stadium talking to him on the phone. And, you know, in a short space of time, we decided, you know, that's it, you just have to stop now, and no more races, there's no point pushing it here now, because you did this before and it didn't work, and you just wear yourself out. So take a break and start all over again. And he said, I think you have something unfinished business at the World Cross Country, and that's what we'll go for next. And, you know, it was amazing, really. You know, I kind of got very unfit, didn't run, went on holidays in Sicily, in a small little island at the bottom of Italy. There was nowhere to run, skinny little streets, and I did no running while I was there. Came back very unfit, and then it was like starting from scratch, starting all over again. I went to altitude for the very first time in Australia and trained really hard there, and then turned up in 1998 at the World Cross Country in Marrakesh.
And won
two gold medals. Yeah. I think, you know, nobody expected it. I didn't really kind of promote it too much, didn't say much to anybody. Just knew that I was ready and just went out there and, you know, won the race.
Yeah, we were all watching that, and we were dumbfounded watching you winning two of them. It was brilliant. In the difference between the track running, Sonia, and the cross country, had you a preference, really? And was one harder or more difficult than the other?
Yeah, well, the cross country is, of course, very hard, and the World Cross Country is one of these things. It's a big race with a lot of, you know, there's loads of people and hundreds of people in it, and they fire the gun and everybody runs off as fast as they can. The track racing, it's a lot more controlled in that you know the pace that you're going per lap, and so it's much easier pace early on, and it's a bit more tactical. Cross country, some people are better than others, and the courses, of course, are different. And I think I probably lucked out in Marrakesh. You know, it was a course that was suited to track runners. It was fairly fast, it was relatively flat, a few little bumps here and there, not much mud on it, so, you know, you could just glide along. I remember I ran in track spikes, and it was in warm, sunny weather, you know, it was beautiful. So it was
a silly kind of a thing I'm going to put you now. When I hear the word Marrakesh, I think of food, and I think of strange food. And when you were away, and you were away in these particular places, I presume you had to be very careful about your diet. And how do you work for food?
Well, I would be, a lot of times you would go into these things and you wouldn't necessarily be thrown into the local food. They'd have a special buffet for the athletes. Yes, yeah. So, you know, so they would have a list of items, you know, that would be athlete friendly, and basic stuff like rice and fish, chicken, maybe pasta, they'd have that. You know, so all very basic stuff, international foods, really, I suppose it would be.
Yeah.
And then they'd have their own local stuff as well if you did want to try it. But generally, you wouldn't until after the race.
Yeah, you wouldn't take any chances. Sydney 2000, Sonia, and the 5,000 metres, Szabo and yourself came around the last bend. I remember it distinctly. I can visualise it in my mind. Talk to us about that final.
I've seen it a couple of times this week now when I've been around to visit a few schools, you know, so they've had the video. And, I mean, every time I watch it, now when I watch it, I kind of think, you wish you could do it again, you know, because I see mistakes that I made in that last lap, you know. I probably went a little bit early, I ran wide, you know. I mean, now I would be looking at it a bit more kind of picky, you know, pulling these things out. But what amazes me is how when we did come off that last bend, that, you know, there was one step between us and she never got any further away and I never got any closer, so we ran, must have ran like stride for stride the whole way, but she just had that little bit of an edge because she was on the inside line coming off that top bend. And it just shows you how, you know, tactically I definitely made a mistake, and I should have waited until we were actually around the bend before I started running fast. And then maybe I would have been able to overtake. But, you know, you never know. And it was one of those things when I crossed the finish line, it was in a way, there was a sense of disbelief that I had actually won an Olympic medal, you know. And then also a sense of how close I was to winning the gold medal, you know, how you were so close, you know, but you didn't win the gold. And so I remember I put my hands on my knees and I had a little bit of a think to myself, you know, because one of those things, you know, are you happy or not or what? And, you know, I think for me, I realised, you know, this is the third time you've tried this, and, you know, to have a silver medal, you know, you've got to be happy. You know, you cannot, you know, an Olympic medal, whether it is gold, silver or bronze, is a very difficult thing to achieve. And, you know, if you can't get gold, then silver is the next best thing.
Yeah.
And I remember I looked up and I smiled and waved, and my coach was, Alan, was sitting in the stands, and, you know, he was a bit nervous that I wasn't going to be happy. But he said when he saw me look up and I smiled, then he could sense a relief, you know, like that. Oh, well, at least, you know, we've achieved something.
You were a winner. You wanted to win the gold because Sonia Sullivan was a winner, but you did tremendous to win the silver. I remember interviewing Eamon Coughlin one time, and we had to speak about his 2 fourth finishes in the Olympics and how difficult it was for him. I would imagine, Sonia, and you just described there coming around the last bend, in all those big races that you ran, there are so many of them, so much coming around the last bend and the crowd bunched together, so much goes through your mind. Your mind keeps changing and changing, and when you're going to go, how you're going to go, where you're going to go, how fast, how slow, and you're watching. I'd imagine there's 1,001 things that you must click in.
Well, there is, but then it's just a split second decision, you know, when you go or what you do. And, you know, sometimes you make that decision and it may be the right decision or maybe the wrong decision, but you have to make a decision, you
one
know,
chance.
At one point or another. And sometimes it is a chance. Sometimes it, you know, there was a time there in the 90s I used to run against Yvonne Murray from Scotland, and I think I used to take off at exactly the same spot in the track every time, you know, was somewhere around 225 metres or something like that, and you were just absolutely leg it. But I think by the time 2000 came, I definitely had to wait a bit longer. You know, as you get a bit older, your speed, endurance speed, you know, it gets reduced a little bit and you're better off waiting till you're closer to the finish line. But, you know, there's time, you have to make these split second decisions. There's no time to kind of think about it too long. You just have to go for it and hope for the best. And
In Sydney, the 1500 metres, then you finished, you had a personal best time. You finished sixth. How difficult was it to recover, or is it, how difficult is it to recover, Sonia, from one big major race to 3 days later? I'd imagine your body wouldn't be 100% right.
Well, generally they say, you know, if you're good enough to get a medal in one, you should be good enough to get a medal in the other.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I suppose at that time you had to run heats in the 10,000 metres as well. So by the time I came to the final of the 10,000 metres, I was on something like coming up to my 75 laps of the track at the Olympic Stadium. So yes, I suppose I had put my body through a fair bit. So going into that race, I definitely had a plan A and a plan B, and because I needed that to get me through the race, because, you know, it's one of these things, if I'm in the race, then I'll be competitive. But if I'm not in the race, I could drift and I could totally fall apart. So the plan B was that, well, you know, if, because we knew that these girls, especially with Paula Radcliffe was in the race, we knew that they were going to go hard from the start, and just didn't know if I could actually go that pace for, you know, that long. And I suppose the thing that really was in my mind was that, you know, the worst case scenario, I run an Irish record and I do the best I can. And so that gave me something to focus on, even though I was running around the track by myself. You know, there was a gap between the, I think there was a top four and then there was fifth and myself sixth. And I really just had to hold my ground and to really focus on pushing as hard as I could to get an Irish record, because at least then I would have felt I achieved something, you know, from the Olympics coming away with that.
Well, it's an accepted thing if you get a personal best in anything you run in that you have achieved what you wanted to do, isn't it? I mean, you can't do it if there's faster than you, I presume you can't do any better. You finished up then your fourth Olympics in Athens, Sonia, and talk to us about then, was your career beginning to dip a bit, or what happened then? And you were really going into that, were you?
I was fine when I got there, but I got sick between the heat and the final. I ate something and I had food poisoning, and I think I just, my whole body was weak going into the final. And I mean, I was good enough to definitely get a bronze medal, you know, to be in the top three. And, you know, it's just such a shame that I didn't actually manage to pull it off. And, you know, you feel stupid, you know, when you go to such a big event and you do get sick like that. You kind of think, well, how could I have prevented that? And, you know, again, it's one of those things where you just do something, eat something that wasn't quite right. And then, you know, once it happens, there's no reversing it. So I suppose I was very disappointed with there, because I definitely felt that I'd been through a lot to get to 2004. I'd been injured since the Olympics in 2000 and been a bit up and down, but I was actually in really, really good shape. And I proved it the week after the Olympics. I ran against Duratra Tulu, who, she finished third in the 10,000 metres, and I beat her in a 5K road race in Hyde Park, and I was flying again. So, you know, it was just very, very unlucky. And, you know, it's one of those things that you just have to kind of say, oh, you know, you just wish you could have done something different and had a better result than, you know. And at the time, I really didn't know that it would be the last time I would run in the Olympics. I thought I'd get another chance at this. Yeah. And somehow, instinctively, coming around that last bend, I had this connection with the people in the stadium and kind of veered out and waved to them. And, you know, maybe that was the writing on the wall right there, you know, that I would never have done anything like that before. But I just felt, you know, they stayed and cheered me on and came down to the edge of the track. And that was the only thing that got me to the finish that day. And I was just so glad that I finished the race. And I felt like, in a way, I kind of came around full circle from Atlanta. In Atlanta, I was unable to finish the race because it was either all or nothing. And whereas here, it was different, and I think I had matured a lot more and got to the point where I kind of thought, well, you know, there's more to it than winning, and you have to kind of you have to finish what you started.
Just staying with the Olympics, Anne, and all your career, the Olympics, is it the pinnacle for every, was it your pinnacle, was the career winning the silver medal, was it your pinnacle?
I mean, I think, you know, all my medals have a special meaning and everything, but the Olympics, you know, it's one of those things that people, their careers are kind of, I suppose, they're marked by Olympics, and it's what determines, you know, do you go for one more Olympics or not? And, you know, it's what prolongs or ends an athlete's career is, you know, how far away an Olympics is and how fit they are, how ready they are. So, but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I would feel very incomplete if I didn't have an Olympic medal. I think to have an Olympic medal just, you know, it just completes the picture for me, you know. I mean, it's a silver medal, but it is an Olympic medal. Yeah. And it's something, you know, that I will treasure forever, and people will remember forever, you know, where they were. And, you know, I hear so many stories of people, you know, my age, or actually probably a bit younger than me now, who would have watched the race, you know, in school or at work, you know, just what happened on the day of my race. It was, I think, something like 10 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, they said people just came from everywhere to gather in groups and watch the race.
Yeah, I know where I was when you won it, because I was a psychiatric nurse in Killarney in the mental hospital, and I watched it inside in a ward with patients, would you believe? That's where I was. Mm-hmm. And in 1956, when Ronnie Delaney won it, I listened to the radio and a bush radio in a kitchen in Killarney, and that's where I them. So right. It's an association of ideas. To give our listeners an idea, Sonia, you ran in the Olympics and the Worlds and the Europeans, the Worlds Cross Country, the World Indoors, the Universities, the Continental Cup. You won practically, I think, 8 gold medals, 6 silver medals, 2 bronze medals, roughly, in your career. You ran over all distances, and then you dabbled in the marathon. Mm-hmm. You tried everything, didn't you?
I did. You know, it was one of those things. The marathon was, I suppose, the ultimate challenge, you know, when you've done so well on the track. I suppose, in a way, the marathon is a thing that I always feel I probably shouldn't have bothered, you know. I never really was able to master that. I don't think my body was made for running on the road. You know, from a young age, when I went first to Villanova, I got injured from running on the road, and I should have realised it later on that I was better off staying to the shorter distances, yeah. And maybe I could have went on for another Olympics.
Injuries, you suffered a good bit from stress fractures, didn't you?
I did. I had quite a few stress fractures early on in my career, yeah, and I think I had I had to go and get some orthotics in my shoes, and kind of, sure how you'd say it now, just I think whatever way my feet were landing and stuff, they just needed a bit more support, and as soon as I did that, then I would progress forward. And you know, I think because of the way I ran and running on my toes a lot, I had a number of Achilles tendon injuries as well. And but when I was injured, I worked very hard, you know, in the swimming pool and on the bike. And you know, I was always training probably 2 or 3 times as hard when I was injured than when I was running. And then when I came back to running, I just appreciated it so much more, because I loved it so much more than the swimming pool used to do, you know, do your head in, you know, running up and down in the swimming pool.
Who were the great names, Sonia, that would be before you now, that crossed you in your career? Rattle off for us a list of the great female runners.
Female runners, oh, people like Zola Budd. I remember watching her and winning the World Cross Country. And she definitely would have inspired me a lot. I thought she was fantastic. And, you know, she's not that much older than me, but she ran really well on the world stage at a much younger age. People like Liz McColgan, who else was out there? Greta Weitz, Inger Christensen, you know. These were, I mean, you know, the popularity of women's sport wasn't huge when I was growing up. But, you know, I remember watching the World Cross Country, probably would have been the big event to watch every year, and to see, you know, I mean, the Irish girls, you know, they never really figured in it, so you would definitely have been more inspired by the internationals and people like Mary Slaney. And yeah, I mean, you know, it was definitely, I mean, the biggest inspiration for me was because when I was really interested in athletics around the kind of mid 80s, Marcus O'Sullivan winning the World Indoor Championships and Frank O'Mara winning the World Indoor Championships. And, you know, that really gave athletics a, you know, it was really in the spotlight in Ireland. You know, they were on television and it showed a lot of, like, Eamon Coughlin running in the Wanamaker Mile and in the Bislett Mile we used to watch during the summer. Yeah. So it was probably on television a lot more. So you could see it. And I suppose when I saw people from Ireland winning gold medals at the World Championships, then I kind of thought, well, maybe I can do that one day too.
What were your favourite stadiums around the world?
I always liked competing in Oslo, the Bislett Games. Always ran really well there, and in Zurich was fantastic. Cork City, the Maradike, always had a great last...
Back home?
Always had a great last 200 there. It felt like a very short last 200. For some reason, I could just fly around up there, and always trained really well up there as well. You know, it was a really nice atmosphere. We used to get a great crowd up there in the Maradike when I was competing.
Yeah. Running at altitude, and Sonia, how did you used to train a lot at altitude, and did you find it helped you a lot?
The very first time I trained altitude was 1998, and then I did a little bit after that. So yeah, I mean, it definitely helped me a lot. I found altitude really useful if I was coming back from injury, because you got a lot more benefit. You ran a bit slower because you were at altitude and it was harder to run fast. You managed to get fit quicker when you were at altitude than when you were at sea level. And I think even, you know, just being at altitude, everything else that you do is harder as well. So whether it's walking around or doing weights, you know, just living at altitude means that you burn more energy, so you get fitter.
You're in Kerry, of course, for this weekend, and that's where I'm fortunate enough to be able to sit down and annoy you with plenty of questions. But you're with Ger Hartman, who is a long-time friend of yours, and Ger Keane of the Hartman Institute Injury Clinic in Limerick. And both men, in particular Ger Hartman, has been a very close friend of yours and a great help to you, son.
He has. I mean, Ger has been fantastic over the years. You know, he was always part of my team, you know, early on. You know, he's not just a physical therapist who looks after your body and treats you when you're injured, but he's also, when he's working with you, he's able to kind of get into your mind and, you know, always very, very positive, you know, and has a huge belief in the ability of people and the ability of himself, you know. So I think that's what allows him to kind of get to the bottom of injuries. And, you know, he's not just treating the injury, but he's treating the problem and making sure that it doesn't happen again in the future, which, you know, it's a great way to be. You know, let's kind of get to the bottom of this. And, you know, Gerard was one of these people who, when a runner is injured, they're not happy. You know, you just don't like to be all of a sudden you can't run. And I remember I'd go to see Gerard and you'd be in an awful way because, you know, you kind of, what am I going to do now? And, you know, he'd be a great one to kind of tell you what you can do, you know, and he'd give you a plan of action and say, okay, well, you're going to do this now for the next few weeks, you can go in the swimming pool. And he'd write me out training programs of what to do, and then after that we'll go a combination of the swimming pool and the bike, and, you know, gradually build yourself up training, and then, okay, now you can start back running, but you're only doing easy running, so I want you to still continue in the pool and on the bike, you know, so that you maintain the fitness the whole time. And, you know, I think Gerard, because he pushed his own body so hard when he competed in the Ironman triathlons and triathlons all around the world, you know, he knew the feeling of training and how, you know, what it felt like to push your body.
Yeah.
And so he was able to understand what you wanted to do as an athlete.
Yeah.
And so he was able to then, I suppose, replicate training in what you can do. If you can't, you can't run, but you can do this, you know. That doesn't mean that you stop training just because you can't run. We'll get you to do something. And then mentally, that just creates such positive energy that you actually get into the cross training, that when you start back running, you don't want to let it go, because you're so used to training about 5 hours in the day. All of a sudden, you're only doing 2 hours when you're running, that you feel like, what am I going to do with all this time?
You don't want to let it go. You're still running is still a huge part of your life, of course.
It is. And, you know, I mean, for me, fitness is a huge part of my life. I mean, I would love to be able to go out and go for a run every day, but I have a few aches and pains these days now, so I can't. So I do a fair bit of cycling as well, and swimming. And I find if I kind of alternate with cycling and swimming, that then I can also get out and do a fair bit. Then go out there and do some long runs and enjoy the running as well, you know. So
and
I think,
of course, Ger Hartman has a good Kerryman alongside him now, and Ger Keane, he's breaking him in, and a great man, Ger Keane. And finally, Sonia, looking back over your career, and of course, the internationals and the Grand Prix, you ran all over the world. It was a good life. It was a profitable life, as you pointed out in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And any regrets now in relation to your career?
Well, I mean, you know, you look back and you see things that you probably could have done a little bit differently, or things that you might have changed a bit. But then if you changed them and you did them differently, then would everything else have fallen into place differently as well? You don't really know. So, you know, I think, you know, things that you do and success that you have is as a result of things that go on in your life, you know. So one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
So I'm sure if I change things, then everything else would change as well. So, you know, I think I always believe my career was very like a roller coaster. It was very up and down. And, you know, the high, when it was high, it was fantastic. And when it was low, it was very low. But, you know, you always, I don't know, I was always looking for the light at the end of the tunnel. And I always had this thing that you knew what success was, and as long as I could get out there and train hard and race hard, then I knew that eventually I would get myself back up where I wanted to be. And, you know, I just keep pushing and pushing and pushing until I actually got there. And, you know, that's, I suppose, when your career comes to an end is when you can't do that anymore. You know, there was a point where I was still training quite hard, but I couldn't get it together and run the race. It just didn't click. You know, it was like I was just worn out, really, and my body couldn't take the training, and I didn't know any different, you know, to train a little bit less and maybe get better results in the race. I just continued on with what I knew. So, you know, I mean, I think I was very high risk as well. I took a lot of risks, and I trained very, very hard. I was the least conservative out there. I would have went out there and, you know, banging my head against the wall.
Two very quick questions before we finish up, and I must ask you about the incident about the flag. And you explain about this in your book, the incident about the flag, the Irish flag.
Oh, right.
Explain to our listeners, when was that, Sonia, again? What happened?
That would have been 1995.
By the way, interrupting you there, you have a great memory. Can you, all the races and all the dates and all the years, can you click them all in if you're asked, by the way?
I'd have to think about it or go on my fingers now or something like that. Yeah. But I always kept a diary, you know, of my races and my training. And I find if I pick up one of my old diaries now and look back on it, there's certain, I wouldn't have wrote loads now, but I did write little things like who I ran with or who I was training with and where it was. And it would, all of, you could picture the whole scene, you know, amazingly. Like certain things now I would have a vivid, you know, recollection of exactly what happened on the day.
Yeah.
But not everything now, just certain things.
Go back to the flag, so I interrupted you.
So the flag, I've forgotten about the flag now. That was 1995. And it was the World Championships in Gothenburg. And I remember I came across the line and it was 5,000 metres now. And I had been more used to running 3,000 metres. And so I came around the bend and some fella gave me this Irish flag. And it was on a big pole, and it was very heavy. And I remember, and it was amazing because when you're running, you actually get lactic acid in your arms as well, and so your arms, like even if you try and lift your hands up, it's quite hard to do.
Yeah.
So to have a big flag on a big stick, you know, and I was thinking, and now I'm going to run a lap of this track. How am I going to manage that? And I gave him back the flag, and I thought, no, I can't do this. And I don't know, people kind of took it the wrong way, you know. I think I just wanted to be run around and be free and not have to drag a flag on a pole around with me. And I suppose in a way I always had, you have a bit of a respect for the flag too. You don't want to be dragging it along the track and things like that. So I don't know, obviously someone in there didn't like it or took offence to the fact that I handed back the flag and didn't want to run around with the flag. And I don't know politically what was going on at the time, if there was, you know, it was different, you know. I mean, nowadays, you know, the flags are given out as people have, certain people throw them a flag and they carry it around. And I mean, you know, immediately I came across the finish line and somebody gave me a flag to pose for a picture, and I did. I had, you know, there was no big deal with that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. He was taken the wrong way anyway.
And, that was a bit of,
I think I had to backtrack and apologise, you know, for something that I didn't really understand, you know, that I had done anything wrong.
Yeah, but there'd be millions of people watching you, and they're all can't bear it. Last question, I must ask you about Lance Armstrong. I've no doubt you'd have been a great fan
tough
if he's
question now, isn't it?
Like everybody is. I don't know whether any question tough enough for you. Big disappointment, everybody, Sonia, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people would feel let down, you know, by Lance Armstrong. I think, you know, the very first time I ever watched and got involved in watching the Tour de France was 1999 when he won. You know, I was just totally taken by it, loved it. You know, I'd never sat in front of a television on an afternoon and watched hours of cycling, and just absolutely amazing, you know. And I think, you know, he inspired so many people to do so many good things, you know, for cancer charities around the world, and people who survived cancer who went out and, you know, rode their bikes for hours on end. And I know some people who actually went and rode the Tour de France, you know, inspired by him when they were healed themselves of cancer, and they kind of thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So, you know, I think a lot of people would be let down, but I think, you know, there was a time in cycling, and it was just a strange culture. I mean, they were obviously all involved in it, you know, all the guys who suppose have told the stories, they were actually taking drugs themselves as well. But
it doesn't say much for the testers.
No, it doesn't, you know. It's like, I mean, nobody's kind of spoken much about the drug tester and said, well, how did they get away with this, you know?
Right,
how did this go on for so long undetected, you know, when you were out there testing, you know? Where was the missing link there? So, you know, I think there's still a lot of answers to be had out there, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people.
You have been tested regularly, Sana, yourself? You would
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you'd have people turn up at your door all the time, yeah, you know, looking for, you know, they could come any time of day or night. Yeah. Nowadays, I think you have to specify a time when they will come. And a lot of the athletes would say, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, because they know they'll be in bed. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if they turn up and you're not there, then you can get in trouble for a missed test. And yeah, I know, I saw something there today. Now, Robert Heffernan was saying it was about the 12th time this year that someone turned up at his door at 6 in the morning, you know, to test him.
Yeah. You're happily married now. You're living in Australia now, Sonia, is that right? Home often?
I'm in Melbourne. My two kids are down there going to school. And I come home as often as I can. Yeah. I was very lucky the last few years being working on the Irish Olympic team as a chef de mission.
Oh, that's right, you had. How did you enjoy London this year?
Oh, it was absolutely amazing, you know. I mean, I was just amazed at how, I suppose, I enjoyed all the other sports so much, you know. Yeah. I mean, coming from an athletics background, I would have thought that my favourite would have been athletics, you know. And as good as it was, I was just to experience, you know, things like the boxing ring, absolutely phenomenal. And just to see how their team operated was brilliant. Anything like going to the canoeing and the sailing, and you know, it was great just to see all the Irish athletes compete. And I think this year the athletes were the most professional that we have ever had, you know. They were all very well prepared and ready to go out there and to do their best. And I think, you know, we're definitely in a much more professional era now of sport, you know, right across the board, from you know, GA football and hurling right through all the Olympic sports. And it's not easy to qualify for the Olympic Games now. So, you know, I mean, the number one thing is to qualify for the Olympic Games. The number two is to go out there and do your best, compete at your best. And I suppose number three, if you can get a medal, then that's the icing on the cake for anybody, isn't it?
Sorry. You know, Sonia, listen to me, I'm after holding you long enough, but come here, it was a great honour and a privilege to talk to you. I've been a great admirer of yours all my life, watching you glued to the television in the ups and the downs. And we laughed with you and we cried with you. And come here, you're very welcome to Kerry. Do you like Kerry, by the way?
I've had an absolutely fantastic time. And I have one story for you. Kerry actually has a very important thing in my life. In 1989, I always say it was a turning point in my career, because I was in college in America and I'd been injured and I wasn't going very well after being a very good junior.
You're going to talk about the human race.
I am, yeah. I always say that was the crossroads in my career.
Where I come from, Talk to us about it.
And I was home from college in America, and the big attraction, it must have been an advertisement or something in the Irish Runner, and the big attraction was the first prize was a plane trip back to America. And and at the time, you know, you had, of course, when you went to on scholarship to America, you had all your schooling paid for and your running shoes and, you know, everything once you were there. But you actually had to get to they couldn't pay for your flight. That was against the schools, the laws or the rules or whatever. So, you know, it was always a bit of a battle to kind of get the money to fly to America. And, I mean, flights back then would have been probably, you know, a lot more expensive than they are now, in relative terms anyway. So to win a prize to America was, you know, a great thing. And I had been injured, so I wasn't training very much. I remember I was running 6 miles every day. I was working in a pub in Cove called the Rob Roy. And I used to run home, actually. I used to do my 6 miles every day in the afternoon. I'd sleep in because I was home so late.
The Rob Roy,
yeah. And I remember I would finish work about 11:30 or 12:00. And, you know, it'd be pitch black. So I'd be so scared to come running home. I'd run home up the hill and out the road and be home in 10 minutes. So that probably all helped along the way. And so my focus was to come down to Killarney and to run this 5K. And a couple of weeks before, I called up Sean Kennedy, and, you know, because I hadn't been training very much, we hadn't been much in contact over the summer, and I said to him, listen, I said, I'm going to do this 5K in Killarney, what do you think I should do? And I can, as clear as day, I can remember him giving me some 600 metre reps to run, some 400 metre reps, or 2 or 3 sessions before I came down here. And I mean, amazingly, I came and won the race and ran 15:30. Which at the time would have been a fantastic time for 5,000 metres, you know. And I think, you know, that just totally, my whole kind of belief in myself and, you know, based on the training I had been doing, was amazing. And, you know, I think it just kind of made other people stand up and kind of look and say, wow, that's amazing. It's, you know, would have been the fastest time, you know, for 5K in Ireland ever, probably on the roads. Might still
you
even
won
be.
You won your ticket?
And I won my flight back to Villanova.
Did the race start outside St Mary's Cathedral in Killarney? Can you remember, Sonia?
I really can't remember, but I know it was very flat. I think it was out and back on a flat road. I really can't remember.
It was American-backed, and there was a lad from Killarney who was the mayor of Killarney, Paddy O'Connor was his name, and he had gone walking to America, and it was he organised the race. And there was a lot of joggers in it, and it started outside the St Mary's Cathedral in Killarney, and I remember that day absolutely distinctly. So Killarney and Kerry had a big part, but you like Kerry, the mountains and the lakes and the sea.
Well, to have had the opportunity to come down here this weekend and, you know, to go out on the bike yesterday into the Black Valley, fantastic down the hills and around the Dingle Peninsula today, and it was fantastic. It was a great bike ride now, and then we came down a massive big hill, 3 miles straight down down to Paddy O'Shea's pub, and for the first time ever in my life, in my hand, I had a gold All-Ireland medal. You know, I said to him, I've never had one or seen one. And he came and he had it in, you know, biscuit tin, you know, give them all inside there. I'm as bad myself now, mine are in shoe boxes. Yeah. And the small little red box and the gold medal in there, like it was in a ring box, you know, beautiful. Yeah. Like, and, you know, they're obviously real gold medals.
Oh, they are real gold,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So precious, you know, that. You know, I think an All Ireland hurling or football medal here down in Kerry means so much more than any All Ireland athletics medal. You know,
Well, come here anyway. Cove might have produced Jack Doyle, the great boxer, and the great of everything. But Sonia, listen to me, we're all very proud of you, and you gave us tremendous memories. The memories Sonia Sullivan has given us, of course, with television and all, and the scene when you came along the line and you were running in the Grand Prix and everything. It was a wonderful time. All I can say to you is, on behalf of everybody in Kerry in particular, Sonia, thanks for the memories and thanks for talking to me.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.